Hello, Caris families. Welcome to our Caris podcast. We are so glad to have you here today. We have Mr. Hoffman, Austin Hoffman, our teacher at Caris. We are going to be talking about one of the Shakespeare plays he is going through in his humanities class. We're going to be talking about Henry V today. So all the questions I have for you, Austin, they're very difficult.
Good. My favorite kind of question.
Perfect. I'm hoping that we'll hear maybe a portion of Henry V today. Mr. Hoffman can recite it for us. I'm sure by memory. You've commonplaced all of it, right?
Well, working on one of them for the next commonplace recitation that we try and do each month. So hopefully I'll have one of the speeches done by then.
We'll ask the eighth graders. We'll check up on you next time. No, I'm very excited about this series from the classroom. Last time we got to talk with Mr. Hoffman about Macbeth, and it was really great. I learned a lot. And so looking forward to talking about Henry V today. So why don't you start out, Mr. Hoffman, and tell us a little bit about this play.
Yeah, so this is one of Shakespeare's historical plays. Henry V is actually the fourth of what's called a tetralogy. I don't know if you've ever used that word before, but it's a set of four plays that coincide together that all take place during the events of the Hundred Years' War. And so Henry V is the conclusion of that tetralogy. He is the son of his father, Henry IV, who had just deposed King Richard II. And now Henry is embarking on his claim to the French crown, actually, and begins a campaign in France to try and claim that crown as well as the English crown.
So I think I've heard Henry V be called the capstone of the plays. Is that correct? Of this tetralogy?
Yeah, it's really the conclusion of everything that came before. In the early plays, we see Henry as a young man. He's kind of a riotous and rebellious youth who spends time in the tavern, getting into all sorts of trouble with his buddies, Bardolph and John Falstaff, one of Shakespeare's memorable characters. But now in this play, we see him all grown up, and he suddenly has to take on this new responsibility, and he's weighing the claims of kingship, both of his own crown, which historically his father took by violence, as well as the crown of France.
Yeah. So do you do a quick historical overview with your students? Do you expect them to know some of this as they come in? How do you enter into going over Henry V?
Yeah, so I think it depends on how I'm feeling on a given day.
Sure.
Sometimes I'll give them the historical context right up front and say, here's the setting, here's the situation, this is what's going on. Other times I'll get right into the play or the work that we're going to be studying. I'll start asking them questions, right? So the opening scenes of Henry V have to do with two bishops discussing with themselves and then with Henry whether he has a legitimate claim on the crown of France. And I'll sort of ask students, well, do you think their arguments hold water? Does he actually have the right to go lead this bloody campaign and lose thousands of lives because it's a legitimate claim on the crown? And I'll get their responses on that, and then I'll start to fill in some of the backgrounds. Well, actually, it might have been his great-grandfather, Edward III, led the same campaign. And here's how it played out, and here are the arguments that they made, and this was the result, and start to fill in some of those details. Henry's father, Henry IV, actually threw the previous king in prison, Richard II, and had him killed. So does Henry really deserve the English crown either? And I think that starts to really open up where they can evaluate these decisions. And then as they gain more context, that allows them to maybe change their minds or go in different directions. And it really helps them develop those thinking skills that we emphasize so much.
Yeah, I think it probably, as they have to probably pivot, I'm assuming, in some of their opinions, it really solidifies some of those thoughts and memories of Henry V. And then, of course, all truth is, there's nothing new under the sun, so it maybe helps them to make decisions in the future. I think that's great.
This is one of the perennial questions. This is why Shakespeare is such a perennial writer to be studied, is that he's asking all the important human questions, so questions of succession. Mm. How do you deal with a leader who comes to power illegitimately, and then he passes on power to somebody else? You know, do you go back and try and right the wrong at some point? How do you provide for succession and this sort of thing? And this is the problem of history.
Yeah.
You have all these great leaders, perhaps Charlemagne or Constantine, and then their successors aren't quite as capable and everything falls apart. So how do you both deal with that problem and then the problem of legitimacy?
Yeah, I was thinking about that, not to sidestep at all, but I think about history and how important it is to know history and what has happened after it for even our, you know, not even all the time, our modern time, because it's just important to know that there are actually consequences to actions and things have been done before. Again, there's nothing new under the sun. So anyways, I guess a little.
There's the point of view out there that history is just the recording of past facts and events that has no meaning on the present because everything is so different. But I don't think that's true at all.
No.
You know, human nature is very consistent across time. C.S. Lewis talks about how we can learn from old books because we're experiencing a mind that is so different from our own. Mm. It can expose our own blind spots and help us to see things in a new light. And then historically, we have to recognize that we didn't come from nowhere.
Right.
We're all downstream from something else. And the problem that often happens to me in these sorts of classes is I start talking about one historical event, like the Hundred Years' War, but then I have to go back in history and I have to talk about William of Normandy and the Battle of Hastings, and then I have to go back to England's foundations, and then I have to go back even more to the Roman Empire, and by the time you're done, you're back in Genesis 1 and the creation of the garden.
That is not a problem. That is a wonderful thing, but I'm sure it takes up your time. It's a great thing for our students to learn. I appreciate that a lot. So again, why we're in for the classroom here for the podcast, we get to learn from you too, Mr. Hoffman. This is great. So feel free to delve into history as we go here. Okay, so I have heard, I don't know, there's like a preemptive apology for the play as he starts off. Do you think that that's true? I don't know if that's the case with the, is it the chorus that they talk about introduce?
So this play is fairly unique among Shakespeare's plays in that this isn't always the case, but there's a chorus that comes on before each major act. So every Shakespeare play is divided into five acts. Mm-hmm. In this one, there's a chorus that comes out and introduces it. But he doesn't apologize so much for the content of the play as that he recognizes that seeing something on a stage is a poor representation and imitation of what actually happened. So he references a horse, right? When you see this image of a horse, you have to think of these armies of horses because, of course, we can't bring 1,000 horses onto the stage. That's impossible. So he's asking his audience to piece out in their imagination the flaws that are inherently there in a play, that it's not actually what happened. It's a representation. And he, in probably three of the acts, he makes the same plea. Like, use your imagination. When you see this, you have to think of this. You know, our cockpits are here. The stage here can't contain the vasty fields of France. So when you hear us talking about Agincourt, you have to imagine it in your mind.
I think that that would be a heavy weight on actors presenting these plays. You start out with Shakespeare's own apology for not being able to portray all these things, but the actors have the weight of having to basically act like this is happening on stage. I think that's why these Shakespearean actors are so incredibly diverse. You have to delve into what is going on behind you and you can't even show it.
Yeah, and to take it to another level as well is when history records what happens, when that is transformed into something like poetry or into a play, it immediately starts getting beyond history, as we were just talking about. It's not just about what Henry did. It's not just about the campaign that he was waging, but it's also about kingship. It's also about succession. It's also about the character of a good ruler. And we quickly move beyond this particular time and place and person to universal human questions. And that's something that a play can do or a poetic tale can do that merely retelling the facts of history doesn't necessarily do on its own.
Yeah, that's good. So one other thing that I've learned about Shakespeare is there's always a high plot and a low plot. Will you talk a little bit about that, what those are in this play, and then maybe what they look like in Henry V in particular?
Sure. Yeah, so I don't know that I've used the terms before, so I may be talking about something different. But
okay, yeah.
Shakespeare is writing for multiple audiences. He's writing for the royal court. So in this case, I believe it would be first presented to Elizabeth I. In this case, about probably 1599, maybe 1600s. But he's also writing for the peanut gallery, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so he's dealing with these high and lofty themes of the legitimacy of the English monarch, which Elizabeth wants to hear, in a sense. But he's also filling in with all sorts of jokes and sidebars and comedic relief that's maybe more similar to an SNL skit than something that's worthy of high poetry. I mean, and Henry V in particular, there's a scene with the princess, the French princess Catherine.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
And her maid, and she decides, well, if I'm going to be married to the King of England, I guess I need to learn English. And so it's kind of comedic relief where she's asking her maid, oh, how do you say, hand in English? And her maid and some renditions will really ham it up and give all the guttural English hand, elbow, neck. And she's really mocking the English language compared to France. But the whole scene seems to be setting up a dirty joke that Shakespeare could put in where certain French words sound like English swear words. And so, the peanut gallery there loves that. And there's a number of other scenes where it's just kind of these goofy characters that don't necessarily advance the plot at all, but it's more there for comedic relief.
Sure.
And I think you see that in lots of modern movies as well, right? There's the little jokes and inside jokes that break up the drama of the movie.
Sure. And it mirrors, not only does it go along with and is like inserted in this high plot, as I've heard before, but it also kind of mirrors what's going on in this like elevated storyline. Have you seen that too?
Yeah, I mean, it does relate to it. So there's one scene, which I believe often gets cut in Henry V, where Henry, during the Battle of Agincourt, gives the order to kill all the French prisoners that they have. He sees the French rallying in the field, and he's worried that if they can get to the prisoners, all of a sudden they have fresh reserves, and their numbers are going to swell, and it's going to be no good. But there's a scene between one of the commanders of the army, a Welsh commander, who Shakespeare really hams up his accent and makes him say all his B's as P's. And he starts talking. He loves military history, and so he goes off on this rant about Alexander the Pig. And the guy that's with him is like, Alexander the Great? It's like, well, large, big, huge, what difference does it make? It's all the same. And he goes off, well, Henry's just like Alexander. Alexander was born in Macedon. Henry was born in Monmouth. See, two towns that start with M. In fact, both of these towns were on rivers. And in fact, both the towns with rivers had salmon in them. So you see, Henry is just like Alex. And it's kind of a joke kind of scene. But one of the big questions that's been going through the play is Henry a mirror of a Christian king? Is he an honorable king? Does he have a legitimate claim? Or is he a sort of tyrant that's just gobbling up lands? Mm-hmm. So even in that kind of comedic low plot scene, if you will, it's putting in front of us, well, is Henry just another Alexander who gobbles up lands like a pig, mm-hmm. with the accent there? Or is he nobler than that? And that's kind of the big question. So yeah, a lot of those low plots are indirectly getting to that major question.
So do you have a translation that helps those of us who are entering into Shakespeare and might not know some of the background, like, oh, this is actually a Welsh dialect that they're joking about? I wouldn't know that if I were reading Shakespeare and not having seen that in a translation. Is there one that you recommend over others?
Yeah, so I found really good success with the Oxford School Shakespeare series. I found, so they're writing for perhaps a younger school age audience. So I find they have copious notes. They have introductions to the various scenes. They give background information. And I found it very helpful for myself in trying to study that they're explaining a lot of the language, pointing out some of the, the details that are occurring, the puns. In some cases, it's perhaps unhelpful to student, and then they explain, oh, yeah, he's actually referencing this swear word, and here it is.
I'm sure they love that.
Yeah, I found those additions very, very helpful, pointing out those things like, oh, this is a Scottish accent, this is an Irish accent, this is a Welsh accent that Shakespeare is trying to imitate in his writing here.
Okay, great. And as you... So I've asked you this before. I asked you this before about Macbeth, but did you ever see the play or a movie? Is there one that you'd recommend or that you really enjoyed? Are you going to be doing that with your class?
Yeah. So my favorite, I think, version of Henry V, I'm trying to remember if I've actually seen other ones. This might have been the only one I've seen, so maybe that's why it's my favorite.
Yeah.
But the BBC fairly recently did a series called The Hollow Crown.
Okay.
Where they put together both of Shakespeare's tetralogies that are dealing with the dynasty of these Henrys. So Richard II, Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, and then Henry V is one set. And then it goes to Henry VI, Richard III, and then I believe Henry VII in the second one. And both, I've watched all eight of those movies, and all of them are very well done. I'd highly recommend all of those. I know I have sitting at home right now a Kenneth Branagh edition of Henry V that others highly recommend, and so I'm planning on watching that at some point, but just haven't gotten around to it.
Is that from 1991? Is that that one?
Yeah, right around there.
Yep. Okay, I heard that. That one is a really good one.
I've also seen recommended an older one, 1950, I think a Lawrence Oliver edition of Henry the Fifth. And what's interesting is that each of these have their own take on Henry as a character. So Kenneth Branagh's edition, I've seen clips of it, but I haven't seen the whole thing, is a fairly patriotic, rah-rah English play, which in a way is what the play is written as.
Right.
It's kind of a go England sort of play, and some have criticized it in that regard. But the Hollow Crowns, really the entire series, is putting forward the idea that the crown is a heavy and weighty responsibility, and that even those that wear it can never really escape that. And so it really brings out some of the scenes with Henry where he's walking alone by himself, you know, praying to God, don't count my father Henry's faults against me now. What difference is there between me and a common man except this ceremony that I went through? And just really bringing out the weight of kingship and the questions that these different monarchs are asking. So,
yeah. So you brought it up a little bit, talking about that it arouses patriotism for England. When you think about Shakespeare writing these things for royalty, right? Didn't in one of these plays, that one of the tetralogy, a king walked out of it because he was so upset? Was it Richard the Second? Is that right?
Yeah, so the play Richard the Second. I mean, this is a good point to get into the background of Henry V. But so Richard II is the king of England, and he came to the throne very young. His father had died, who would have been the crown prince, Edward IV, known as the Black Prince. But yet he died before his father, Edward III, had passed on the crown. So he never actually took the crown. So Richard inherits it, I believe, when he's 10 years old. And so the kingdom is largely ruled by nobles and his uncles. So one of them in particular that's important is John of Gaunt. But he has a number of other uncles running the kingdom until he's of age. And then, of course, when he comes of age, he has this need to assert himself and take control. And so there's this struggle dynamic going back and forth between him and his nobles. There's a dispute that arises between his uncle John of Gaunt and I believe the noble of Gloucester. He ends up disinheriting John of Gaunt's son, Henry Bolingbroke, of his lands, kicking him out of England because of whose side he takes in the dispute. Henry ends up coming back, leading an army, and deposing Richard II, and then becoming Henry IV. And as this play is going on, and sort of these different scenes, and you see Richard, Richard is generally regarded as a poor king. He raises taxes too high, he mistreats his nobles, he's not seen as a noble king. But then Elizabeth, who is watching this play for the first time, storms out and exclaims, right? Know you not that I am Richard? And she clearly sees herself in this character and does not like the insinuation that Shakespeare is making about the monarch.
Yeah. So was one of the next plays, is it Henry IV, that he wrote to kind of appease her? Is that right? Or did that not happen?
Yeah, I don't know that he wrote it specifically to appease her. But right, this is what makes Shakespeare great, is that he doesn't have flat characters.
Yeah.
So I mean, in as much as you want to look at it and say he's portraying the monarch in a negative light, you could just as easily turn it around the other way.
Sure.
You know, well, as we've talked about Henry V being a rah-rah patriotic play, it's very easy to read the play and see Henry not as a good king or an honorable king, but somebody simply exercising his own power for his own gain.
Mm-hmm.
He takes a joke from the French prince, the Dauphin, of tennis balls, right? Go back to your games, kid. And he just loses it. And he stands before a city and he makes these horrible threats of violence if they do not surrender. He orders his men to kill the French prisoners, which is expressly against the rules of war. And so it's not hard to look at the play and see, well, although Henry is called the mirror of Christian kings, mirrors also show opposites, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your right is your left is your right. And so that's what makes Shakespeare so dynamic and so great, is that it's not flat characters.
So good. Yeah. I have to say that part about the tennis balls really caught me. It's like, oh, I wasn't expecting to see something like that in a Shakespeare play.
Yeah. So can I read a few lines from that scene?
I was going to ask you. That would be great. Thank you.
So I won't read this whole one, but I think this shows Shakespeare's mastery of language, because he's in one section, he has Henry sort of on the spot deliver all these metaphors, right? So the Dauphin has given him a gift of tennis balls, which is sort of the joke, like, go back to your games. We know how you used to live before you became king.
Yeah.
And Henry begins to speak to the Dauphin and just listen to all the tennis imagery that comes through in these lines. When we have matched our rackets to these balls, we will in France, by God's grace, play a set, shall strike his father's crown into the hazard. Tell him he had made a match with such a wrangler that all the courts of France will be disturbed with chases. And so in those short lines, right, you have rackets, you have set, you have hazard, you have strike, you have match, you have courts, you have chases, and all of these are alluding to the game of tennis as it was played. The game's changed somewhat now. But then later on, I want you to see if you can hear this. If you've ever watched a tennis match on TV and you hear that sound of the racket striking the ball, you know, kind of that muck, muck, muck sound as it's going back and forth. Listen to these lines and see if you can hear that tennis match happening. And tell the pleasant prince this muck of his hath turned his balls to gunstones, and his soul shall stand sore charged for the wasteful vengeance that shall fly with him. For many a thousand widows shall this his muck muck out of their dear husbands, muck mothers from their sons, muck castles down, and some are yet ungotten and unborn that shall have cause to curse the Dauphin's scorn. And so in that repeated muck, muck, you almost have this tennis match taking place in his words.
Mm-hmm.
That you can hear that repeated word making that happen, which is just incredible.
Fascinating.
So my students were like, wow. Henry can really come up with speeches really fast to say all that.
Like, he's good.
Yeah.
I think that also goes to show it's really important to read these things out loud, even if you're just to increase your enjoyment of it, but even understand what he's doing. That is a great example of that.
Yeah, reading out loud. And then even though it's difficult reading the original, I mean, I recommend having, you know, if you want to find an edition that has a modern paraphrase next to it or find notes next to it, that's all well and good. But as much as possible, because Shakespeare is writing this in blank verse, there's a rhythm to the words and a cadence that you can fall into. It's a da-da, 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 da-da for each line, that iambic pentameter.
Mm-hmm.
And once you find that, it really carries you along like a musical line. But then also the language that he's using and all these metaphors and similes, once you start to say, this is what this means and this is what this means, you lose all that. And you lose the multi-layered effect that you can get. And it's well worth the difficulty to struggle through it to be able to enjoy it in that sense.
That's great. So how long does it take you to go through Henry V with your students?
This play, I think we've been going at for maybe 2 weeks and we're right about to wrap up. Some of that may have been because I'm trying to have them do some other projects alongside that in a more history-directed bent. So I want to, you know, make sure it's light. But it's always the challenge of assigning reading because you want to give them a good amount that you're not taking forever to go through the book. But at the same time, you want to slow down and be able to enjoy it. So it's always that tension of trying to find, you know, a good amount, but not too much.
Sure.
Yeah. I'd much rather just read the entire thing in class and go through, you know, scene by scene.
Yeah. Well, you hope that I'm sure that they are inspired and encouraged to, as they come back to it in future years,
come back
with the more well-rounded knowledge of what's going on with Henry V.
Yeah, and that's the hope. You can't get it all the first time. You got to keep going back, and there's always something else to get.
Always something else. It's beautiful. Well, is there anything else that you would like to talk about with this play or something you could share with us from?
Well, can I read one of the speeches.
I was hoping that you would. Which one are you going to do?
So this is the Once More Into the Breach, Dear Friends.
Oh, beautiful. I think we could say this in our homes sometimes, right? I've heard that other parents do this. Once more into the breach, go clean your rooms.
Yep, as you're getting ready to start the day, ready to go back into war. Now,
perfect.
So this is Henry, perhaps at the first major battle on the French side of the English Channel before the Castle Harfleur. Once more into the breach, dear friends, once more, or close the wall up with our English dead. In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, conjure up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favored rage. Then lend the eye a terrible aspect, let it pry through the portage of the head like the brass cannon. Let the brow o'erwhelm it as fearfully as doth a galled rock o'erhang and juddy his confounded base, swilled with the wild and wasteful ocean. Now set the teeth, and stretch the nostril wide. Hold hard the breath, and bend up every spirit to his full height. On, on, you noble English, whose blood is fet from fathers of war-proof, fathers that, like so many Alexanders, have in these parts from morn till even fought, and sheathed their swords for lack of argument. Dishonor not your mothers. No, attest that those whom you called fathers did beget you. Be copied to men of grosser blood, and teach them how to war. And you, good yeoman, whose limbs were made in England, show us here the mettle of your pasture. Let us swear that you are worth your breeding, which I doubt not, for there is none of you so mean and base that hath not that noble lustre in your eye. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slips, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit, and upon this charge cry, God for Harry, England, and St. George!
Oh my goodness. That was great. I would come and see you on the stage, Mr. Hoffman. That was great. Oh, inspiring. Oof. Okay, well, if you need to rouse yourself to do something difficult, that's the speech to bring up.
Yep, Act 3, Scene 1.
Beautiful. Oh, I love it. Thank you so much. Thanks for sharing with us. Thanks for letting us enter into your classroom, Mr. Hoffman. We'll do this again soon. Before we go, anything else you want to share with us? I know that was great, but or could you give us a recommendation? It does not have to be Shakespeare related.
Well, today is Favorite Literary Character Day at Karis. And today I'm dressed up as another Shakespeare character, so I think I'm going to have to give another Shakespeare recommendation.
Beautiful. We love it.
Today I am Caius Marcius Coriolanus, another of Shakespeare's tragedies, a Roman soldier who fights in numerous battles for Rome, wins many wounds, but the plebeians despise him, and he in fact despises them. So after he returns from one battle, he refuses to show his wounds out of a sort of modesty or humility, but the plebeians rally together, exile him from the city, at which point he joins up with Rome's rival and begins waging wars against Rome. So as he comes back to Rome, not as her defender, but as her conqueror, various friends and senators and his family members go out to try and entreat him not to burn their city down. And all of them fail except for his mother. His mother, for which he has done all of these great deeds, implores him, convinces him to make peace between the Romans and the Volscians. And finally, Coriolanus relents, agrees to make the treaty. His mother goes back to Rome as the victorious matron who has persuaded her son to turn away his sword. But the Volscians, with whom he's allied, do not take kindly to this, and they kill Coriolanus, a martyr for his city. I would recommend that play. T.S. Eliot said it was Shakespeare's greatest tragedy.
Oh.
Starting to come around to that, but it's very good. So I would highly recommend that one.
Wonderful. Okay, great one to read on Mother's Day. Okay, well, thank you so much. We'll do this again soon, Mr. Hoffman. Thanks for your time. Karis family, I hope you enjoyed this time when we entered into Mr. Hoffman's humanities classroom. I will post a picture of him dressed up, but Mr. Pointner is dressed up as Henry V today. So we'll post a picture of him as well on our social media sites. So have a great day, and we will talk to you soon. Thank you.